Good morning, folks. Welcome to the Solar Fit Renewable Energy Show. Bill Gallagher here with you today. And listen, if you hear some rumbling out there, it's not my stomach. We're down in Daytona Beach, and it's the start of Bike Week, and there's some Harley Davidsons roaring by. So we're with our good friend and our guest, Mr. Jack Kerfoot. Jack, welcome to the show.
Bill, it's a pleasure to be on your show today.
Well, I know you can't hear it from where you are. Where are you now?
Portland, Oregon, where I'm looking at it. Snow out my window right now.
Holy moly. I know you guys have had some crazy weather out there.
Yeah, well, it's still a little bit of snow. We don't get that much, but it is, you have to be prepared. That's right.
Gosh, I wish Gloria was here. She's from the Portland area. She lived out there most of her life, but she's been working with us now for 23 years over here in the Sunshine State, like I say, at Daytona Beach. Jack, you have such a resume here. If you could, tell the folks, the listening audience, a little bit about your background.
Vietnam and started university in the early 70s, and 73, that's when the U.S. was hit with an oil embargo. And so my interest in physics and math and science, I went into geophysics, and I ended up going into the oil industry primarily as a way to serve our country, because at the time in the 70s, our country was devastated by the shortage, a lack of fuel. There were fuel lines, people may not remember them, to the gas station where they can only buy a few gallons at a time. And we were seeing inflation rates of 10, 15, 18%. So the world was under a stranglehold of a lack of fuel because of OPEC. So I went into the oil industry and then spent about 20 years overseas, traveling the world from Indonesia on two locations, Vietnam, Malaysia, Australia, Oman, Turkey, Holland, UK, and Canada, and the U.S., quite a few places in the U.S. And then I've started a consulting business, and I clearly see the advantages and the importance of moving to renewable energy as efficiently and as quickly as possible. So I also blog on my website, www.jackkerfoot.com, and I wrote a book called Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. I put that second part in there because when I did an analysis on energy books out there, I was somewhat shocked to find that maybe myself and only one or two others actually had written books on energy that had actually had any history or background in the energy industry. So I thought it was worth telling my career around the going around the world. And I tried to write it so a non-technical person could read it and understand the changes in the energy dynamics, not just of oil and gas or fossil fuel, but also of nuclear and also renewable energy, and the importance of renewable energy in our immediate and our long-term future.
Well, Jack, if we could go back a little bit, because it's very clear in my mind, because I was around during the time of the initial oil embargo, and you're absolutely right. If your last name started with K, like Kerfoot, you had 6 gallons on Thursday and another 9 gallons on Monday. I mean, it was a crazy time, wasn't it?
It certainly was. It certainly was. So, fortunately, I was in university then, so I rode my bike, so I didn't have to worry about it too much. But yeah, it was a crazy time, and the economy was absolutely devastated by that. And the U.S. was in a stranglehold, dependent on foreign fuel that we really hadn't come to realize over the time. What's interesting to realize is in 1941, the U.S. was the largest producer and exporter of oil in the world. But after the Second World War, by 1950, we became a net importer because of our increasing use of and purchasing of the automobile. So fossil fuel has become an intimate part of our life, not only coal for utilities, but also oil for everything from fuel for cars and planes and trains, but our everyday life, things from contact lenses, medicines, synthetic fabrics, plastics. So if you actually try and spend a day without coming in contact with a oil product or oil-based product, you would be hard-pressed, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, in thinking along those lines, what are your thoughts now with the advent and the escalation, fast escalation of electric vehicles?
I think it's very good, but I think we have to be prepared because if we make that rapid move, and I think we can, I think we can for several reasons. The biggest impediments right now are the battery. You can get your Tesla automobile and also the Chevy Bolt. which can get about 250 to 300 miles on a charge. But there are new batteries out there that have been released, and they have claims that they can get up to 450, 500 miles on a single charge. One of the batteries that's just come out has claimed that they can actually get a full charge, 500 miles on their charge, in less than 10 minutes. So if we can get that type of charge, then we're talking about the type of time you'd spend charging your vehicle like it would be going to a gas station. Now, the next hurdle is to get the number of charging stations out there. And right now we have about 160,000 gasoline stations across the U.S., and we have maybe 1,600 to 2,000 charging stations, public charging stations across the U.S., but almost all of those are in the urban areas. So what we'll need to do is to get those charging stations out on the highways so people don't have to worry about trying to find a charging station. I have a friend who has an EV, and he's based in Bakersfield, and so whenever he drives out more than about 50 to 100 miles, he has to plot out where the charging stations are and plan his trip very carefully. And I think the moving to charging stations could easily be achieved by if the federal government or state government were to implement tax credits for charging stations. And I think we'd see the gasoline stations quickly make the move and start putting charging stations in their facilities.
Boy, I agree 100%. And when you're thinking 450 miles, gosh, I don't know about you, but I have to take a bathroom break way before that. So if we're able to get these set up, and I guess what I envision is, you know, on restaurants and frequently visited locations, solar panels on the roof to charge the charging stations. Is that your vision,
yeah,
too?
Absolutely. Whether it's directly through the utility or whether it's from solar panels on the actual charging station itself, absolutely that could be the source. So, but what we have to realize, again, what the title of my webpage is Our Energy Conundrum, because there's no easy or simple solution. We're going to have to realize as we move from, I think we have about 350,000 electric vehicles in the U.S. right now, to what we're talking about, millions of electric vehicles replacing combustion engines, we're going to see the demand on for our power increase maybe 30 to 40% of what it is right now.
Yeah, and that's really another reason why, you know, in conjunction with fossil fuels, at least initially, that more solar power and wind and these other sources are necessary, because when you're talking about expanding the requirement by that, you need a lot of horsepower.
Absolutely. What one thing a lot of people don't realize is one of the impediments to the development of more renewable energy facilities is land access and access to lay the highline wires. I know I've read about several solar parks that have been held up because conservation groups have opposed the development of the solar parks because they take up green space. And, of course, there's always opposition to wind farms or wind turbines because people say they don't like the wind turbines spoiling their view. But at the same time, we have to recognize that fossil fuels are not without limits. You know, fossil fuels are not a limitless supply. You know, British Petroleum estimates that we have maybe 50 years of economic, what I call viable economic oil left in the world, maybe 100 years left of natural gas. In the case of coal, we're already seeing the depletion of the coal. The highest quality coal, the anthracite, has virtually been mined out in the U.S. So what we're seeing now is the cost of power from coal is more than double the cost on a kilowatt-hour basis on a what I call a levelized basis where there is no real tax credit involved of onshore wind and solar, and even hydropower is more than double for that right now. And the reason for that, quite candidly, is they're using the lower quality coal. It takes more of that coal to generate the same amount of power as the higher quality coal like anthracite. And now the cost for transportation on the railroads is 3 to 4 times the actual cost of the coal itself on a per ton basis. So those costs for fossil fuels are only going to go up as we continue to deplete our resources.
Well, for sure. And of course, the extenuating circumstances from a health standpoint of burning fossil fuels and coal and things like that, they're always there on the back burner. So something like wind or solar or hydro or anything where you can generate this energy without having any hazardous byproducts just sounds like common sense, really.
Well, it does, and that's why I like to say the debate on climate change, you're studying for the wrong test, in the sense that it's unlikely you can get a climate skeptic to agree with climate change or the theory of climate change. But what you can argue is the unequivocal data that shows that burning fossil fuels emit CO2, and that creates the pollution. And if you've ever been in cities like Los Angeles, Denver, or Houston, you can not only smell the pollution, you can see the pollution. And if you've lived in Southeast Asia like I have, and you've been to the large cities in India and China, on the winter days, when the smog is at its worst, in Beijing, you can put your hand out, and you can't see the end of your hand because it is that thick. We are talking about cities of 20, 25, maybe 30 million people, whether it's Beijing, Shanghai, Mumbai, New Delhi. So that evidence of pollution is unequivocal. And then on top of that, if we bring in the economic factor, I like to ask climate skeptics, do you like to save money? Because if you do, you want to encourage the development of renewable energy.
Well, for sure. I a little story about what's happening in parts of Asia. I was talking to a fellow who was a professional tennis player, and he was telling me when he was playing in China that they had to find ways to practice inside because when you go outside, it's not good for your health. There's no way you can breathe, and that's just a crazy way to live, really.
Yeah, and we have to realize the impact on the health. The World Bank did a study for China. They estimate over 100,000 people a year die or premature deaths are caused because of the air quality. When you're in these large cities, and I'm not talking about one or two, it's the 32 largest cities in China. Of course, it's 1.4 billion people. Everyone wears a face mask because the pollution is toxic, and you can visibly smell it, and then you take off your mask after a 15 or 20 minute walk, and your mask is brown. So that's like being in the depths of the coal mines and people then discovering a black lung from the coal dust. Effectively, you've got the same thing from the pollution from these coal plants that they have in China as well as the other fossil fuel plants.
Well, that's can you imagine walking around somewhere in the United States with a mask on and going into a 7-Eleven? I mean, you wouldn't last 10 minutes. They'd have you in handcuffs. This is not good.
You would have a different life-threatening event. That's true.
Well, I was out in L.A. about 2 months ago, and, there's times of the day there. Like you said, it's kind of a brown haze, and you can barely see 2 miles away. I can't imagine when you get to some of these cities in Asia, but even in L.A. and some of these places, it's just like it has to have an impact on your health as far as shortening your lifespan, I would think. Well, wow. Hey, folks, stay with us. We got to take a short commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Jack about the environment and climate change. Right back.
Is your roof making you money? Hi, folks. Bill Gallagher with SolarFit. If you had a SolarFit solar power system on your home today, it would be making you money. I'm talking thousands of dollars. We can solar power your home. We can heat your pool. We can run your air conditioning with no money down. What are we waiting for? Give us a call today for a free estimate. 386-445-7606. Online at SolarFit.com.
SolarFit your life and set yourself free with the sun's free energy.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the SolarFit Renewable Energy Show. Bill Gallagher here with you with my friend Jack Kerfoot. Jack is the author of Fueling America, an Insider's Journey. Jack, before the break, we were talking about, of course, renewable energy, but pollution and things like that. But, a question that I have is you're so in-depth in this, and I know that you've dealt with politicians and all the way up and down the line, and there's this huge debate going on about climate change and all these different things. It just seems really kind of crazy because you can obviously see that something is happening when the ice caps are melting. And, of course, we're down here in Florida on this little peninsula. And, if we have tidal changes, if something happens, we're very, very subject to this. How do you convince people that how do you convince people that climate change is real?
Well, I think the first thing we have to realize is that it's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. Actually, the states that have made the most progress in developing renewable energy since 2005, and 2005 was an important year. That's when bipartisan bill was passed for the 2005 Energy Act, which put tax credits for renewables, also fossil fuel and nuclear energy in place. And so from 2005, the amount of electricity generated in the U.S. was over 51% from coal. Today, it's about 29%, and it's projected by the Department of Energy to be less than 20% if the current trends continue. So I think you'll find that actually Republican legislators, congressmen, and senators from the Great Plains states like Texas, Ohio, Oklahoma, Colorado are strong advocates for renewable energy. They see the advantages of it. The farmers in those states see it's tremendous because in Oklahoma, which has gone from virtually zero renewables to over 40% since 2005, the farmers are out there. They may have a producing oil well on their fields, and they may also have wind turbines on their field, and they get revenue from the wind turbine and the oil to supplement their crops or their fields if they have, where they may have cattle, or where they may be growing wheat or cotton, depending on where they are. So I think you'll find that those areas are very pro for the continued development of renewable energy. Now, the tax credits for renewables expire in 2022. They've been escalating going down. And I think what the real push we need to do is to encourage our legislators to increase and extend the renewable tax credit bill that will expire in 2022. And the reason for that, quite candidly, is we're now, the next big move in energy is offshore. Europe has been developing offshore wind farms at a rapid pace over the last decade. Germany last year brought in over 1,000 megawatts of offshore wind just in 1 year, and they're expected to be over 30 megawatts of offshore wind energy, let's say within the next year or two. We have to realize that wind quite now is always stronger offshore and more consistent than it is onshore. So that's why offshore wind has so much potential along the east and west coast. Move away from the climate change. We have people in the White House right now that are climate skeptics, but at the same time in the Republican Party you have strong advocates for renewable energy. And you certainly have advocates for renewable energy. What doesn't help are some of these polarizing, hate-filled rhetoric that we see on both sides. And we have to remember, we need our politicians, Republican or Democrat or independent, to work together for the betterment of our country, not to get votes and to make a headline or make a tweet.
Boy, we couldn't agree more on that, Jack. This voting along party lines never has made sense to me. I mean, you know, we're voting people into office to make decisions for the betterment of all Americans, and to just stand behind one faction makes absolutely no sense. Yeah, for sure. So some of this, let's talk a little bit about the Green New Deal, which has really made some headlines lately. What's the story with that?
Yeah, my quick assessment of the Green New Deal is it would bring chaos and economic disaster. With that said, you realize, of course, I am a strong advocate for renewable energy. And the reason I make that statement is not every region in the U.S. has, I don't think, with current technology, sufficient renewable energy resources to provide sustainable, reliable power if you exclude nuclear and all fossil fuel. Some regions, such as the Southeast, may require nuclear after closing their fossil fuel plants. And certain states, even the state of Florida, will be challenged because right now your electrical power is about 70% from gas, 13% from coal, nuclear is about 14%, and renewables about 3%. So that's a huge move if you exclude nuclear. And even if you don't exclude nuclear, it's going to be a challenge because solar takes up space and you're a rapidly growing state. I believe now in population you've even passed New York. And in growing in population, while New York is decreasing in population. So the Green New Deal would close all fossil fuel and nuclear power plants, which is 83% of America's current electrical power sources, and replace them with just renewable power, and in only 10 years. The plan plan is also designed to accelerate the move from internal combustion engines into electric vehicles, or EVs. The move to EVs would further increase the power demands in the U.S., I would estimate by 30 to 40%, and that's assuming it's not a 90% rate. It would be a normal trend that we would see projected up based on Department of Transportation estimates on where they think we're going to be in the next 10 years. And I think it's unrealistic to think that state utilities could select optimum sites. We can't just throw a dart on a map and say, well, we're going to put a solar park here, or we're going to put a wind farm here. Acquire the land, permit the facility, and then get the permitting for the solar parks and wind farms while laying thousands of miles of power lines in only 10 years. So I would say it's unrealistic from that time frame. I would also caution that I've studied countries around the world that have made the move to renewables, and rapidly poorly planned programs result in power outages and 400 or 500% price increases. I saw that in Australia, the state of South Australia, that went from 40% renewables to 100% renewables in about 4 or 5 years. Unfortunately, what happened is they didn't anticipate the fact of variability of the renewable energy. They didn't have battery storage, so what they had was brownouts, and they had a 400 or 500% increase in electricity prices. So the other factor is we also have insufficient number of electrical engineers and mechanical engineers, technicians, and drone operators to support the thousands of new wind farms and solar parks that would have to be built over the next 10 years. So my fear is that the rapid move would almost certainly cause major power outages across the country. That would impact hospitals and emergency services and our businesses. So from an energy reliability, power reliability standpoint alone, it is a proposal that I think is poorly planned.
Yeah, again, Jack, I agree. What we need is controlled, steady growth and cooperation on both sides. You know, it almost seems like before a freshman senator enters into the arena that they should have to take some basic training. Maybe we should open up a basic training, Jack. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure where she's getting her advice. I mean, the good news is the new Green Deal is totally impractical. The good news is, though, it's getting people to discuss renewable energy and the climate. The tactics that she's using, such as getting a bunch of school children to go and basically ambush Senator Feinstein to sign on the deal for the new Green Deal, I find completely inappropriate. And some of her antics I find over the top. But look, she was elected, and like any politician that we vote in, sometimes we get it right and sometimes we get it wrong. I suspect the voters of the Brooklyn area may change their mind next time she's running for election.
I think we'll do better next time. That's a good answer, too, Jack. It just seems a little bit, I don't know, crazy to me. I don't know. But, you know, I guess when you live long enough and you see all this stuff, nothing should surprise you for sure.
So, well, unfortunately, people have gotten used to sustainable power and reliable power, and they take it for granted. And the move transitioning from one power source, let's say coal and natural gas, to renewables is going to take time. And unless we want to basically take away people's rights to, in a normal permitting process, you have a facility and you set it up and people can express their opinions for or against the installation of power lines or building a solar park. And so there's always hearings and then there's evaluation and then they make the decision. Unless you want to take that process out and basically take the right for citizens across the U.S. to object to installing a wind farm or solar park in a particular area, or at least hearing their opinion, which I don't think the American public would take that too easily, then I think the Green New Deal is completely impractical.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, what I would really like to see, Jack, is more cooperation between the utilities and industry, renewable industry people, where there isn't this constant, you know, pressure back and forth, where they're actually supporting each other. A perfect example is that it's a comment you made about us. We're going to need more electric energy, right? No way about it. Well, if distributed solar was supported, you know, by the utilities, where homeowners were really encouraged to put solar on their house, where they didn't have to purchase that energy, they were actually making it. it would be much easier to transition as opposed to just relying on the utility grid.
Yeah, and it's important to realize that some utilities in some states have done that, have started to do that. Hawaii and Arizona in particular. There's a Del Webb complex in Arizona. Everything has got solar, and the solar panels are interconnected with all the houses, and excess power can then be sold back to the state utility. So you do see that, and another thing I'm an advocate for is further deregulation of the utilities. When I lived in Houston, Texas, which is the most deregulated state of all our 50 states and the District of Columbia, I could go online and I could buy electricity from 22 different suppliers. And part of that basically says that the access to the power transmission lines can no longer be blocked by one utility or two utilities. So I could basically buy my electricity from 22 providers. I could buy it for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, or even 2 years, and the prices were stated up front, and they were fixed. So that's one of the reasons I think you've seen that Texas is now the leading state as far as wind energy. 15% of their total power is just from wind, and now they're making the next move into solar. So here we've got the state known for its oil and natural gas become a real leader in the development of renewable energy in the U.S.
I love to see that. I love to see that happen. Yeah, well, that's great news. You know, there is a petition circulating here in Florida for the listening audience, in case you haven't seen it, that is really attempting to do what Jack is talking about, which is open up the opportunity for people to buy energy from more than one utility. We've got several monopolies here in Florida, and we love our monopoly, our friends and everything, but it's just a constant struggle, and I just think cooperation and everybody getting behind it would make such big progress.
Yeah. Well, I will say one thing. It used to be called Florida Lighting and Power. I think it's Next Energy or Next Era. They do have one of the largest, they build and operate more wind and solar parks than any other utility in the U.S. And in fact, the utility I have up in Oregon, PGE, Portland Gas and Electric, basically brought in FLNP to help them build a hybrid wind and solar park in the northern part of Oregon, north central part of Oregon near the Washington border, simply because FLP had the expertise and PGE did not. So again, what we also have, if that's why we need sharing and collaboration, is we have pockets of expertise, but not across the board. And that's why you're seeing wind energy being developed in the eastern U.S., and even though the strongest winds and most consistent winds in the entire United States are off Oregon and Northern California, absolutely nothing has been done to develop offshore wind potential in those two areas.
Well, that's something that could easily be done on the East Coast too, because we're, when it's no longer the NIMBY theory. You don't have to listen to it. You don't have to see it. It can be off there doing it, and it's not gonna cause any problems. I'm sure that the boating industry would go right around them.
Well, actually, there was one pilot project so far that began operation the end of 2016, and initially, and you have to go through a normal permitting process with any offshore operation. And you have to involve the fishermen, and of course you do environmental studies and geological studies to make sure it's stable. And initially the fishermen were skeptical. 12 months later, they were absolutely applauding offshore wind because they create many reefs. And you see the same thing in the Gulf of Mexico, where all the platforms have been since the 1960s. Those oil-producing platforms create many reefs and actually encourage and enhance the development of fish populations wherever they are. So I think you'll find in most areas that the fishermen initially there will be reluctance, but again, you need to start that process to have those discussions to get it going. So again, collaboration is the key word, and let's avoid the polarizing hate-filled rhetoric, regardless of left or right or in between.
Amen,
and look for ways to make this country better.
Amen, Jack. I'll tell you what, we're on the same page on that, folks. Jack really knows what he's doing. Hey, Jack, we're just about out of time here. Could you please tell people how they could access your website and your book?
Yes, the website is www.jackerfoot.com. My book is on Amazon.com, Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. It's also on Books A Million and Barnes & Noble. It's starting to get some pretty good activity on that, so I think you'll find that it's an easily readable book if you're a non-technical person. And one person sent me a note and said, not only was it enjoyable, you snuck in information on energy, and I'm more informed than I've ever been. So I hope you'll find it to be a good read. It's gotten some good reviews.
Beautiful.
Amazon reviews and Goodreads and Google reviews as well.
Beautiful, Jack.
So, I hope you also visit my webpage. I get about 5,000 readers, let's say every 2 to 3 weeks, and I typically post 5 to 7 blogs a week.
Awesome job. Jack, we're out of time. I have to go. I'm very sorry. Thank you, Jack, for coming on.
It was absolutely a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You're very well. Folks, go out there and buy the book. It's well worth it. And have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week.
SolarFit and Renewable Energy Radio Show, paid for by SolarFit.